Welcome to session two of Marry Me Dash, What Human Relationships for Married and Singles. When we were kicking around trying to come up with a title that would snag everybody's attention, we came up with about five or six, each one with the title of the book, Marry Me, but then dash something else, and one of them was Human Relationships Inside and Outside of Marriage, and that just lay too close to the plot of the story, which is the story of a crisscross multiple adultery. And that was relationships inside and outside of marriage, but we didn't want you to get the idea that that's what we were talking about in here. So we dropped that one. You remember the characters in our little book? This happy foursome, Jerry the Lutheran and his wife Ruth, former Unitarian, now Congregationalist, their three children, and then the other couple, Sally and Richard. Richard, the self-proclaimed agnostic, no, I think worse than that, atheist. And Sally, who had been raised Roman Catholic, but I think we decided yesterday that God for Sally was kind of an empty category, didn't have much meaning for her at all. And what we looked at yesterday were some of the differences between Jerry and Ruth, largely, that caused roadblocks to their relationship to each other as people. They saw each other as somewhat different, and they said, different is terrible in this department, and we can't stand it. One of the differences was religious difference. For Jerry was frightened and sort of clinging to God as something out of his past that would give him some stability, some security in life. Ruth looked on his fear and on his clinging to God as kind of a kinky thing to do. She found his fear to be unacceptable weakness. She found his clinging to God to be anachronistic, hanging on to something very obsolete that a modern day 20th century man ought, for goodness sakes, let go of. Please.
If she characterizes his religious life in that way, why is it that when she goes to church, it's such an emotionally debilitating experience for her? And as I recall, the scene that you read yesterday describing the baptism of her second child, with her in the borrowed hat and so on, and she was about to burst into tears, and was that simply that somehow she felt that she was being unmodern, or was it that there's a kind of awakening of religious impulses in her that are wholly unresolved, and that she doesn't know where she stands, and in some sense she's afraid about the implications of this or any kind of thing.
I think you're right. She's very busy fighting down within her those religious impulses that are there, because they overwhelm her. She can't handle them. They come from, I don't think I can find the place in the book, but there is a place in the book in which she's described in her family of origin as having been left out. Her father, the Unitarian minister, I don't know what's wrong with me this morning. Maybe if you'd all clear your throat with me. Thank you.
Did you have breakfast?
I'm probably dying because I didn't. Mother, thank you. She is described as the child in this family where father was very dedicated to all different kinds of causes. That's dreadful to have to listen to this. I'll shut up in a minute. And mother was very dedicated to father. And she was left out. Can you see that there might be a connection there, then, for her to anything that smacked of things religious? That's what robbed her of her father. I think a not unusual happening in a parsonage, by the way, because of the pressures on the father, because of the many people he has to care about, and here's a child who never received father's care, and concludes that they're, you know, concludes somewhere along the line that they are unacceptable, and that they've been beaten in an unfair competition by Holy Mother Church and real mother in their pursuit of father's affection. So, you know, I'm psychologizing now. That's what I'd look for underneath in that kind of a mess. But the net effect of it is exactly as you described. She gets into any kind, anything that looks like religious function for her, and it just blows her away. She can't handle it. She finds all kinds of feelings, some possibly religious, but many of them not. Many of them the feelings left over from a situation in childhood where she was deprived. So, religious differences between Jerry and Ruth, and then we talked about differences in attitudes towards death, of all things. Maybe the theme for this week is death. It begins to look that way. Okay. That's recapping yesterday. Now, what do you got in mind, kid?
Well, did you want to go on with another difference from the book, or did you want to switch to other differences? You have down here this one. The other thing we want to do today is not just tell you about differences, but we hope to get to some some approach to solutions. You know, we said yesterday, okay, you know, if we talked about different religious things in a marriage, and what do you do then? Well, do you just do what they did in Marry Me, and that's not resolve it and end up with a mess? Or are there ways that you can resolve some differences? And when Ralph talked about the people whose oldest son didn't join the Lutheran Church because that was understood ahead of time that it was a mixed marriage and that's how things are, that really is one solution, you know, to make it very clear ahead of time how things are going to be. If you're not going to resolve it before marriage, you're probably, at least religious-wise, you're probably not going to both decide to do something else 5 years later. If you're each going to stay in your own church, well then, you better have some pretty good understanding of that before you get into marriage. But we do have some of our old marriage enrichment techniques that can be used as solutions too. You want to go on with this?
Yeah, let me read this one. I found the section I was talking about earlier. I didn't know I had it all marked up here, but I do. This is Ruth now. Her affair has ended, and she's talking about the meaning that this affair had for her, and I think we can kind of see through that the meaning that her present marriage to Jerry has for her. The difference being here, the difference in which people hold a common marriage, the different meaning it has for them. On the whole, she was well satisfied with her affair. And as she zipped up the children's snowsuits or closed a roast into the oven, thought of this adventure snug in her past with some complacence. She judged herself improved and deepened in about the normal amount. She had dared danger and carried wisdom away. I think that's Unitarian thought. Do you recognize it? A more complete and tolerant woman. She had had boyfriends, a husband, a lover. It seemed she could rest. I have a psychiatrist friend who does marriage counseling sometimes and says, there are some people who just seem like they gotta have a love affair somewhere around age 40, or life is incomplete for them. I'm not sure I agree, but there's the same thought. She had had boyfriends, a husband, a lover. It seemed she could rest. She had not quite intended Jerry never to know. She had done it, her conviction grew in retrospect, less for herself than for him. How's this for a wild idea? Her surrender to another man came to seem a kind of martyrdom, a martyrdom without an audience. While the affair was on, she had pictured Jerry's knowing as a thunderbolt, a burst of noise and revealing light, a cleansing destruction. That sounds more Lutheran than Unitarian, don't you think? Instead, her marriage had stood with the stupid solidity of an unattended church. And when she returned to it, guiltily scrubbing the floors, recovering the sofa with blue sailcloth, cooking with newly bought rack of spices, studying the children's school papers as if each were a fragment of gospel, Jerry gave no sign of noticing that she had been gone. Crunch. Awareness of Richard, physical memory of him, and physical anticipation of their next meeting had filled every vein while the affair was going on. Trembling and transparent and brimming, she had stood before the mirror of their marriage and was given back nothing. The sensation was familiar. Here's that section I mentioned earlier. Her father had been absorbed by love of his fellow man, and her mother by love for her father, and Ruth had grown up with the suspicion of being overlooked. That little section is loaded with all kinds of things, but what I'd like you to tease out of it is the way in which she's viewing her marriage. And it's very different from the way in which her husband is presently viewing his relationship with his mistress. And very likely, very different from the way in which her husband had earlier viewed their marriage. For him, it was really a big deal, terribly important. Once forever, all that kind of stuff was in it for him. For her, it seems to have been more a passing thing, a trivial thing, a convenience of some kind. So again, a difference in attitude. It causes them to not be together. Let's move from that example to another one. What's making that noise?
Are you doing that, Larry? Stop it now.
Is that the way he snores?
What kind of bird?
What kind of bird, right.
Maybe a flicker, I'll have to look and see.
Okay. It's a delightful sound.
Yeah, they do.
If it phones me, I'll put it out of that.
That really is a toad?
A toad, if there's
somebody,
a place where differences occur these days in families has to do with lifestyle.
Just thinking of a couple of them that we've gone through recently, either at our own level or again with our kids who are just getting on to the marrying age. I guess just maybe in the last 2 years, Paul has started to back off a little bit and say, you know, I've been climbing to the top of the heap for a long time, and I think I'd like to relax a little bit more. Some of you have heard us talking about a farm that's coming from Paul, although I agree with it. But I've just recently started working up to the top, you know. And so for me, I didn't want to leave the city completely and live on a farm totally, because it's just been the last couple of years that I've gotten some recognition for what I've been doing, and that I've really been able to put myself wholeheartedly into a job that now I almost feel is a career. And so for a while there was some real conflict over that. Paul would see me working more, going to more meetings, spending weekends, going away from town for workshops and things, and he was, although he had done plenty of that in his day, was beginning to say, you know, gee, there's more to life than working all the time. So we've begun to work through this, and when we talk about the farm, we talk about it two different ways. The farm has to be close enough to the city so that I can still go in every day and work because I want to, and still it has to be away from the city so that Paul can get away from the demands and the pressures and the things that he's gone through for 25 years. I think when young people start looking at marriage too, they have to be pretty honest about what they expect as to be their lifestyle. Some of you know Mary Jo. She'd spent a year at Holden. She's still kind of a footloose and fancy-free person. And if she would enter into marriage, she would certainly, the person that she'd marry would really have to understand that she's not the least bit ready to settle down, and probably won't be till she's 40 the way it looks. You know, she wants to travel a lot. She wants to do everything that comes along. She keeps talking about college, but something else always enormous comes up in the meantime. And she's got to do that for 6 months first. And if two young people get together and one of them's saying, well, look, I guess we can get married, but I don't want to get tied down yet, and the other one is thinking in their head about vine-covered cottages and cars and babies and things like that, but agrees and says, oh, yes, of course, we won't tie ourselves to anything. We'll just float around and do what we want to do. But in their heart of hearts, the second person is really thinking the traditional kind of settling in. I think they're in for big trouble, because they need to be honest about where they are, or they're going to end up with an enormous difference in a short time that either needs to be resolved then or could lead to bigger trouble. And I guess maybe we could spend a few minutes talking about the lifestyles that you're experiencing. Maybe some of you that have been married for a while have, it's become kind of a melting pot of both of your ideas and what you want to do. But maybe some of the younger people that aren't married yet at all realize that there can be drastic differences in the way you hope to live. Ben, and I doubt if he's here, he doesn't usually sit in on these kind of things, is our most traditional. He's our youngest, but he's the most traditional. He's the one who probably will get married and live in a vine-covered cottage. And Mike and Mary, Mike's kind of he's the oldest, but he's kind of the in-between as far as lifestyle goes, you know, have way different ideas of, Michael says he's going to make his living by repairing bicycles during the summertime, and he's going to make so much money doing that. This is his first summer doing it, but he's going to make so much money doing that during the wintertime he can be a sculptor, and that's what he's been studying in college. You know, it might work. It's hard for me to say, and of course it's his life. His, and if he marries the girl he's going with, Gloria's, they need to work that out together. But maybe we can take some lifestyle problems and talk about those.
I think maybe the livest one in this room, from looking around, might be lifestyle differences between parents and children. Some of you along the wall there, what sort of lifestyle ideas do you have, and how well do they fit with your parental lifestyle? Uneasy movement along the wall. Anybody on that? Do you see it? Is it for real? I mean, you know, not just the superficial stuff about how long your hair is and how raggy your jeans are, you know, but real substantial differences in how you're viewing your life path. My son, Michael, if he continues on the path he's on now, will probably never have a mortgage of any kind. That would be too limiting. I've had God knows how many more. And in fact, that when I was his age, when you finally got a mortgage, then you were probably a genuine human being. Before that, you were a punk. Right?
Yeah, I just think of the mortgages. I know what you mean.
Well, my lifestyle changed from my parents. It was after I was 22 or 23 years old. They never went to church, and I never went to church as a kid, and then I decided to go into seminary. And
you went to church once or twice in between, right? You went to church once or twice in between.
After I met.
Uh-huh.
But that was hard for them to buy. They didn't see the need for organized religion. My brother is an agnostic. And so we're on two different ball fields altogether.
And what does that do to the relationship? Can I push you to the next step?
Well, it first of all, it just created distance. Because the hardest people I found a witness to is my family and any kind of ministry at all. And so we had an incredible amount of distance, and they had they just couldn't see the need for this. They kind of wanted to know where they went wrong. You know, why I wanted to go to
Okay.
That's true.
We laugh, but that hurts.
Yeah. And they would come up to our house, and I'm going to seminary in St. Paul. I'm an internship now. And they couldn't understand this. You know, we were in student housing, and they just couldn't understand it. And it was just like it was a whole new world to them, or a different world, and a world that they didn't care to get married to. And now my dad died last Thanksgiving, and I think it's been a good thing for my mom, because now she's been able to come to me a little more and talk about God. So I think it's working out. But it did cause an incredible amount of distance. And at distance, I think that we decided not to try to resolve, but to try to live with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was no getting rid of the difficulty.
No.
These were non-negotiable points that you and your father had taken.
Mm-hmm. And it's, well, you know, he was 55 years old, and although there's room for change, you know, he just, all his life, he could see no need for organized religion. And his son entering seminary, or at least in his mind, was not going to change that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, I really think that the feeling that they had gone wrong somewhere was in his mind. You know, needing this type of crutch, maybe. Because he was, both my parents were the ones that were kind of self-contained. And they could exist within themselves.
Sounds like Ruth to me. The attitude towards religion sounds like Ruth's attitude in this book. Almost a burned child reaction. Ah, religion. Get it away, get it away.
My mother was raised at Reform, so there's part of that problem.
Okay. Which means religion's no fun.
Right. It's a big law.
Yeah. Does that ring any bells for anybody else?
One thing I was thinking before you mentioned anything, I was going to, one time I bought a TV, and at one time I wasn't watching it at all, you know, so I wanted to sell it. And I told my dad about this, and he thought I was crazy, you know. What do you want to get rid of your TV for, Bib? What are you going to do? You know, you just couldn't relate to, you know, that. So I kept it, but I still have it. I don't watch up here, I don't have it now here, but it was kind of funny just to, you know, have his reactions. I didn't think he'd react to it like that. He just went, well, what are you going to do? You know, why do you want to sell your TV? You know, what are you going to do? What are you going to do? How are you going to find out about the news or anything? You know, and I was really surprised with his reaction. And I don't know.
He thought you were resigning from the human race.
Yeah, right. In a sense. And there's another thing about, you know, health insurance too. You know, my parents think I should have health insurance, and well, that's probably a good idea, but the one I have is too expensive right now. But I wanted to drop that, and then they think I should have health insurance and also relationships. So I want to try and find a cheaper one.
I think we're talking about a lifestyle difference.
Yeah.
That gets in the way. Father's imagining is, you know, step one, sell a TV. Step two, go live in a cave with a bear, right? Or something like
that. Yeah, because I guess when he grew up, they didn't have TVs, and to have a TV was just something that was good, I guess. But I don't really particularly care for television, because I find myself being able to watch it too easily and become attached to it or something.
Part of the... You said we were going to get to some solutions. an interesting kind of solution that appears in this book. We've drawn out a bit some of the differences between Jerry and Ruth, husband and wife. And after Jerry lets Ruth in on the fact that he might want to divorce her if it's going to be all right with her, you know, and marry his lover Sally, they begin having a new kind of conversation. And the scene is a little seafood place or something where it's dark, and they are talking. They've had difficulty talking about it. You know, the news is out now. Jerry has told her what sort of decision he's wrestling with, and Ruth is trying to respond in a reasonable Unitarian way to this sort of crisis in her life by being reasonable. And so they're having a conversation about it, and this is going on at a restaurant because they felt safer having a conversation there. They each would need to maintain their own composure. You know, you're not going to blow up and throw things at a restaurant, probably not. And so this was a way to kind of keep the lid on and keep the conversational flow. And here it is. The coffee had come. All around them, they noticed now conversations were proceeding. The world proceeded through such conversations. Jerry and she, after years of living together like children with invisible parents, had begun to talk to each other like grown people. Yeah, there it is, huh? There's the solution to these kinds of differences, to talk to each other like grown people, to not talk to each other like two children with invisible parents. Now, you get anywhere with that?
You talking to me?
Yeah.
Oh, well, where I could express to him my feelings about the television or something? Or
yeah.
Yeah.
Do you?
I should have, but I didn't. I just kept the TV. So I still have this TV.
It's very difficult. Not only
when I go back on.
Part of the difficulty is it doesn't just take you talking to Father as though you were a grown person. It takes him talking to you as though he were a grown person.
Yeah. And it takes both of you listening to what the other person has to say. And I you know, this isn't an enormous problem, but I can imagine that if he would hear you out, he would have to agree that what you're saying makes really good sense. And other times, if you would hear him out on some of his, you know, same thing. We do a, are you going to try some diets, or are you not going to do that here?
I don't think so.
Okay. We, if you've been in any kind of group settings, you've probably done a thing called a diet or a triad, where you not only speak to the other person, but the other person, everything that you say, that person repeats back to you to make sure that they've heard you, because it takes two people to have a good conversation, a talker and a hearer, and then you have to reverse that. And then another solution kind of technique that Paul and I have used, we teach people to use it, and it's just really simple, and maybe you use it on your own without even knowing it, but have you ever found that when you write something down, it becomes clearer to you? Mm-hmm. You know, you can think it a million times, and you can have this whole fight going toward this other person, and it can just go round and round and round in your head. But when you finally put it down on paper, your own feelings are clarified, and it's easier to convey those to someone else. So we teach this always in marriage enrichment. If you're having trouble, sit down. We call it 10 on 10. For 10 minutes, sit down, write it on a piece of paper. And then if you feel like it, exchange those pieces of paper. Well, along about Christmas time, and Paul was telling somebody this last night, I don't remember who, but some friends of ours got married, and they asked us both to preach at the wedding. And we had never done anything like that, and we had to write a sermon together. And Paul's been preaching for years and knows all about preaching, and he's good, you know. And I've just taken, I've just taken one course, and I thought I knew more than he did because I'd just taken the course, and everything was really fresh in my head, and I knew exactly what was supposed to be in a sermon. So we went out to our cabin for a weekend, and we were going to write our sermon there. Well, we spent the whole first day fighting. He would say, well, this is what we're going to say, and you do this, and you do that, and you do that. And then, and I'd say, now, wait a minute, you didn't listen to what I thought we ought to say. And I'd try and tell him. He'd say, oh, it's dumb, it's no good. And we didn't get anywhere. And finally, the second day, on Sunday, we sat down and said, let's try a 10 on 10. And it sounds almost too cutesy pie to be true, but we sat down. And it was more like a 30 on 30 because we wrote and 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 wrote. And then we said, phew, man, do I feel better? And we exchanged those pieces of paper, and we each read what the other person wrote, and then we wrote the sermon. And it was just really easy and beautiful after that. And it was crazy how a technique that we had told other people to use for years finally solved that problem for us. And you don't even have to exchange the paper, and you don't even have to be with the person that you're having the difference with. You can, your father can be downstairs, and you can be up in your room, and you can write it all down on a piece of paper, and it's going to be a lot better for you now if you can make the next step and get that paper to your father or to your wife or to your husband or whoever the difference is with. Then things are even better. But I think just getting it on the paper and out of that stew pot that's your head, you know, helps a great deal. And if Jerry and Ruth had done more of that, now the little part that Paul just read is at the very, very end, they finally learned to talk to each other as two adults. Up until that point, they were living together, more or less, and they just kept running into walls, and instead of trying to work it out with the person they were married to, they'd each run off to somebody else and do their 10 on 10 or whatever with that person. Well, that's not going to solve the problem between these two.
Yes, I was just wondering whether when you work through this 10 on 10 thing, and I'm familiar, I mean, I've done it, but part of it is not just when there are problems and there's a stew pot brewing, but in a particularly happy time, I think it's important also to put down those happy things, possibly also to share, so that, especially in a marriage, if you just got those nasty notes, sometimes it seems all bad, but to share the good times also, or to think, if you're just doing it by yourself in an upstairs room, things are really going well. Write it down.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful. And I think a difference between my kids and myself is that they would not go out and buy a commercial greeting card that's below them. They will not buy a Hallmark card or anybody else's card. And as a result, they write letters or notes or do something on a special day that says so much more. They put down on a piece of paper how they feel about us, and all the rest of the time they can let that go. But I've learned that even though that takes more time to do and more effort, I personally appreciate it so much, so I guess that other people must too, you know, Paul, kids.
That's
right, and the good stuff.
Yeah, where the tangle usually comes, and it's exemplified beautifully in this book, has to do with feelings, for God's sakes. You know, not with getting the laundry done, but with feelings about it. And that's what you concentrate on when you do your writing. And I guess what we're saying, partly, about ourselves, when we go to something as structured and almost corny as that, that's how I feel about it. When I have, you know, when I, who ought to know better, have to sit down and do this dumb writing bit, I'm feeling like kind of a cripple, which I guess is what I am. I can handle all kinds of emotional things, but there are some emotional things I can't handle. Okay, that kind of a cripple I am. But here's a nice crutch to get me through it. And so I write. I don't always feel good about writing, because I don't like being confronted with the fact that I'm a cripple. But another way to think about it is that's very much like what goes on in a lot of counseling, isn't it? Those of you who do some counseling know that. What you're doing as counselor is you're kind of being a piece of paper that taking what the person is giving you and giving it back to him for him to look at. And that's very, very clarifying. And if you're a good counselor, you're paying attention to the feelings that are there, because that's what is so difficult for the other person to pay attention to. Please, Harold.
I'm just wondering if you would speculate a little bit. Supposing Jerry and Ruth wrote 10 on 10. Supposing what Ruth wrote was that insofar as I am religious, I'm kind of a theist or a Unitarian, and I find that all of the stories about Jesus and his redemptive Savior and so on are nonsensical, and I understand very clearly that I simply believe that. It's not a matter of anything. I find organized religion very inhibiting to individual expression and so on and so forth. And it's just very clear about this point of view. And he, on the other hand, after a period of self-examination, said that I've been living kind of a sham too, and I discovered that Jesus Christ is my Lord and Savior, and is very important to me, and organized religion and the community of saints and so on is. And so they exchanged it. What will that do? I mean, will that lead to kind of adult recognition that they're incompatible, or is there some other possibility?
I think there is another possibility that if Jerry could see Ruth's position as one that a reasonable human being might take, and if she could see his position in the same way. Now, that's going to take not just information, that's going to take some giving, isn't it? That you see that the other person's position is, you know, not utterly off the wall idiotic. But you could see how they got there. You can see where they are, and you can see how they are holding this position, not just out of some, you know, fear about the world crashing in on him, and her not just totally out of some thorough rejection of the pain she experienced as a child from her reaching toward a father who did not reach back. If each can see the other's position as reasonable. If carry the picture to the other situation we've been talking about, parent and child, if the parent can see the child's position as one that, okay, is indeed different, but not necessarily one that is self-destructive, not necessarily one that is headed straight for hell in a handbasket, but as a position that is being taken and is reasonable.
Parent-child relationship, though, is often understood as one of growing autonomy. And
yes.
Good parents really wish this kind of independence. And I suppose one can conceive of a marriage as a partnership of autonomous individuals who respect each other very much. On the other hand, I think in some cases one might get into a bind because the reason for the marriage is that they have a large set of needs that would go beyond what could be fulfilled by simple respect and care for you as an autonomous individual.
A marriage that would not be two autonomous individuals but would be two people kind of leaning on each other.
Well, at least they each want that, but discover that their belief systems require a kind of autonomy from each other. So mm-hmm. they genuinely do need mm-hmm. to, you know, look to somebody else for whom they can be closer because their belief systems are more compatible.
That certainly would be one way of defining the difficulty between Jerry and Ruth, is that you view their marriage as a succession of stages in their relationship with each other. For a while it worked. But then as certain needs, other needs began to appear, it didn't work. They were not two autonomous individuals. They were needy people in ways that didn't mesh very well. Earlier, the needs for being met. That's not an uncommon thing to have happen in marriage. A marriage that is really super for a while can, you know, have a transition stage and then a period when it's really terrible.
We can affirm your therapy of writing or whatever, the 10 on 10 thing, over a period of many, many years now. We have had long separations from our children from first grade through college year. And we have kept all of their letters that they have written and they had to write when they were in boarding school and had to write to us every week. And we have kept all of their letters and given them to the children now recently so that they have a whole diary of their life from first grade on. And, you know, with all the problems and conflicts that they had with their boarding parents, the Troutons, whom you know, and their peers through all the years, I mean, all this we had to do by writing letters. And then Herb and I were separated for long periods of time also, over many years. And we have all of our letters to each other. And it's really interesting to go back and look into those files and see the kind of things we were talking about at that time. We still write a lot of letters, and people are saying to us, we never, you know, we don't know how to write letters, and we have found that people in the States, you know, really don't know how to write letters. I mean, I am fine, how are you? That's it. But, you know, sharing feelings and things, you know, that are really hurting or things that you're happy about, those things can be written down and are very helpful in whatever problem comes.
It would probably be easier for you to do some of these techniques because you've had a history of letter writing than it would be for someone else who really hasn't written any letters for a long time. And now, you know, some people come along at a Holden workshop and say, gee, if you're having trouble, why not write it down? And still, I think once you've tried it and found that it does help, there are other things that work and help too, but just to pick one out of the whole batch of them, that's probably one of the most helpful ones, I think.
Oh, yeah.
Let's tell them a little bit about Fair Fight, even though we won't try and do it.
Let's not. Well, I'll write you a letter about it. Okay. I think one of the what comes to me is strongest criticism of my parenting of our older son Mike after he had left home and gone away to college in Minneapolis. I would write him occasionally, and I have a terrible time starting to write letters, but once I'm into it, it gets, you know, long, keeps going, say all kinds of stuff, sound familiar to somebody. And he would respond. He responded once to one of my letters that I had written him by saying, gee, Dad, I didn't know you thought all that stuff and felt all that stuff. Why didn't you tell me some of that while I was still at home? You know, crunch.
But one thing, now this is sidetracking a little bit, but we did realize that there were times, especially with teenagers, that some of the things we had talked about for years together when they were little, you know, every time Paul gave the boys a haircut, they had a sex education lesson going.
No, sometimes it was the internal combustion engine.
Okay. And that's where they learned those two things, was when they got their hair. And then when they were about 12, they started letting their hair grow longer, and then we realized, too, that another thing that we weren't talking about after they were 12 or 13 years old was religion. We had for years, you know, talked about what happened in church on Sunday morning and talked about getting ready for school or Sunday school or what. And then it was like when they became teenagers, we expected them to go completely on their own. Well, somewhere along the line, when they were all in their teens, something happened to some friends of ours where the daughter got involved in something and ended up saying to her parents, gee, I didn't know you felt that way about it. She had a child out of wedlock, and she wanted to keep the child, and she wanted not only that, but wanted her mother to bring up this child so that she could work, and was surprised that her mother wasn't wholeheartedly in favor of the whole thing. And so we said, well, gee, you know, we think our kids know where we stand on a lot of things, but maybe we need to. So we had two weekends, and maybe it's just because we're workshoppy people, but we had a religion weekend where we went out to a place in the Ozarks, resort kind of place, but, and then we just spent morning, afternoon, and evening, and we'd intersperse it with a swim or a tennis game or a hike or something. But we talked about how we feel about God, and they did too, and we didn't agree on everything, but at least now they couldn't say that they didn't know we felt that way. And the next year we did a sex weekend, and that time we went to my folks' cabin, and Ben was the youngest, and he wasn't just all that interested in it. And he kept saying, let's go for a boat ride. Let's go do this. And we could say, no, now we're going to talk about, and, you know, we'd have the afternoon. And I think it wasn't the easiest thing in the world to do, just with your own kid. But I'm glad we did it, because we had talked about it, well, I said this, but we talked about it for years, and then we just sort of stopped talking about it. It was like they had gotten their education. I suppose they had. But I didn't want them to say, I didn't know that's how you felt. And so now they know. Now, if what they choose to do may not still be in agreement with what I believe, but they can't ever say they didn't know that's what I thought.
It's a patch job on, I think, realization that communication is incomplete, and that maybe it needs a patch job once in a while. And which has, for me, some of the same connotations as the necessity of sitting down and writing. Has, you know, it says, well, I didn't do a perfect job of it. All right, so for whom is that news? That's what we say about ourselves.
And just one more little thing to put that on an entirely different level. Last summer, my parents came here while we were here. My parents are celebrating their 50th wedding anniversary, so you know they're, you know, full, that much older. And my mother and I, when we did dishes back home when I was a kid, I used to ask her a lot of questions. And she would always answer them by saying, you'll find out that after you get married. And standard answer to almost anything I'd ask. But we went to Stehekin one day, and so we took the morning bus down to the lake, and we sat down there, and Dad and Paul went off walking. And Mother and I talked about sex and sex education for the first time in our whole life. And I think it was just because we were in a place where it was very easy to talk, and where we had been close to each other all week long because of the Holden experiences. And she felt that for the first time she could talk about some of these things that she had never felt that she could talk about before. And I guess so some of it too is the right time and the right place, and maybe even the right year, you know, after so many years. But I guess I believe what makes all relationships go around, what makes them work, is communication, written, spoken, getting it out in the open between parents and kids and between couples. And
it's really very difficult in American society, because I can just think of my own life where when I go to work in the morning, my kids are already on the school bus. When I get home at 7 o'clock, I got to take a 15-minute supper and go out to a meeting at 7:30, and I get home at 10:30, and they're in bed. This goes on every day for months. You know, it's really hard.
People can really get out of touch with each other.
Right.
And just taking the time then, mm-hmm. you know, the weekend or whatever, and being
planet.
Yeah.
It's not going to happen by accident.
The things that happen by accident are probably some of the best.
Right.
And at the same time, if they're not happening, then you got to plan them.
Right.
And it's got to be a combination of the two. And if you can look back over the last year and say it hasn't happened at all, then it's probably time to plan something.
I think the ideal marriage is when you marry your best friend.
And manage to keep it that way. Yeah, those of you who heard Jeanette's sermon last Friday know who is not her best friend. She talked about all her friends.
You're talking about.
Yeah. Right now.
like what Deb was talking about, when the child, the grown child, decides to take a little bit of different lifestyle, the parent will take that as a message to them that their lifestyle is within them, or that you are rejecting what they call the good life. That she rejected perhaps the things that they really worked hard to get to. I know I kind of get that kind of thing from my parents. The thing that they would want most for their daughter, I think, is now that she's been through college, she'd go off and marry a doctor somewhere and work happily ever after. And I'm talking about, well, I've quit a good job and I'm going to leave the state or leave the Midwest, you know, go really far away. And they just can't quite take me seriously that I've left this job and I'm going to go somewhere with no security, no job, no friends, and just kind of start something on myself. And I kind of feel that they're taking it as something that I'm doing to them. When they talk about different instances where there are friends of the family or people in the town where someone had a child out of wedlock, they go, well, I hope none of my children do that to me.
Your different lifestyle is taken as negative critique on theirs.
Mm-hmm. Kind of looking at it, they kind of feel it's an ungrateful thing. And it's not true at all. It's just that it's something that I'm not ready for right now. I consider myself a really traditional person, but not as traditional there.
Yeah.
I'd like to try two things on this, but I don't know whether this is going to work, but it's picking up what Carol said, more from a biblical angle. It would seem to me that what you're talking about, and I'm a bachelor, I don't know if you know that, has more universal aspects to it, and I'd like to try it out on two aspects. One is the Esau-Jacob story, so even they were twins. They could have different plumbing, and they could be what you call friends living together in that sort of stuff. And then it would seem to me that it's natural that one person gets blessing and success and one doesn't. And that this is a rivalry, and it's a continual rivalry. It's a very interesting story from that angle, the relationship. And then another biblical story, and that is the one that's talked about here, the family. And that would be kind of the Joseph story, where the aspects there are much wider. And in both those cases, it seems to me that one of the things that you say before, or much said before, is a natural tension. I think it's still good. Otherwise, we wouldn't have a socialization of ourselves. We don't understand any of it. Am I making any sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But that's just my contribution to what I'm hearing here.
Okay.
Yeah.
Reflecting on that?
Or? Yeah, I am. I don't know where I'm going with it, though.
Well, let me say it this way. The Esau-Jacob story somewhat ends, if I just take it as a story, with an odd sort of reconciliation, where, I think Larry Rasmussen is going to have that as a Bible study soon, the man who is wrestled with God, Jacob, comes by, he gets the blessing, and then meets his brother, and calls before his brother. And then that's somehow, they part and they go different directions. Whereas the story in the Joseph story, with all the fight, you know, getting rid of one of the brothers that's causing the trouble, and all that, ends too often with reconciliation. But after a long, long time, and a long, long time. So I think the reconciliation is there, but it may not always be at command or when you want it.
Uh-huh.
And to me, I think those stories are more general. They're not yet part of the Jewish relationship or the Jewish covenant to husband to a Jewish wife under the covenant, nor a Christian relationship. That's something else too. Even more primal, you might say.
Yeah.
That's the thought I'm trying to think this out. It's what Harold really said. The question. may take us in a different direction, and we haven't got much time, but I just wanted to share one thing that I'm discovering. In parent-child or intergenerational relationships, and nobody ever told me about it, I'm learning it by myself, and that is that I'm jealous of the next generation. If death is turning out to be one of the themes, I'm discovering in middle age that I'm experiencing a lot more anxiety about death. And the way I am treating my own children now has an awful lot of jealousy in it. For a long period, they were an appendage to my life. I would introduce them as my children. But as they are on their own, they are no longer an appendage to my life. And I am discovering that they will have a life of their own. And that life, by all the actuarial tables, is going to be longer than mine. And it's going to be different than mine. And in many ways, it's better than mine. They have better values, better educational opportunities, a lot of things that I did not have. And I am just very frankly jealous, and not only of them, but of all younger people. I look at young people with slim bodies and strong muscles and boundless energy and skills I don't have, and I say, damn you, you know, why have you got things that I didn't have? It's something that I really have to struggle with. And one of the ways I struggle with it is just say it flat out. For me, it explains a lot of things. Why people my age hang on to values, why we want to see those values perpetuated in young people. It's a way of living on, but it's also a way of being vindicated. It also explains a lot of hostility of younger people to older people. They are literally elbowing me out of the way to make place for themselves. I don't like it. I'm jealous. I have a lot of this stuff going. I think it needs to be said because I think I'm not the only person who's feeling this or who has felt it.
I add one more line to that. And please. They've changed the rules on us, haven't they?
Yeah.
Damn it. And it's not fair. But I'm with you 100%. I was reflecting last night during the forum in here and feeling cheated that such a forum had never occurred in my life when I was 15 or 20. Those kinds of discussions just flat did not go on. Right? In nowhere that I know of when I was a young person. And to have the young people sitting around in here, we were talking about death and dying, and having an upfront kind of tell-it-like-it-is discussion about the meaning of death and dying. I had to wrestle in my guts with that stuff all by myself for a long time. And I was thinking, yeah, they're getting a running start at it. How fortunate for them. How unfortunate for me. Funny note to end on, but we're out of time. You just heard a loud growl from the older set.